Hello and welcome to Team Talk. In our third episode, Milestone founder Chris Padgett, that's me, and a clinical psychologist and Milestone trustee, Dr. Ilan Ben-Zion,
that's me,
chat with Patrick Foster, or Foz as he's pretty much universally known, about his experiences of living for nearly a decade with a secret gambling addiction that took him right to the brink of taking his own life. Foz is incredibly honest about his experience of battling and inspiringly overcoming his addiction. With the prevalence of gambling in today's society, and especially in the world of sport, gambling has become this unescapable but widely accepted social norm, and Foz's message about how easily it can infiltrate every part of your life is pretty sobering. We of course chat about the impact that his gambling addiction had on all parts of his life, from his relationships with his family and friends, his mental and physical health, his work, self-esteem, and of course his finances. But the real takeaway for me is the importance that Foz places on communication and setting aside the fear that we all understandably have about being judged or worrying what people may think of us, but to allow our support networks to be exactly that, a source of support when we need it the most. In Foz's case, it was the call that he made to his brother Sam moments before he was about to take his own life that literally saved his life and set him on the track to recovery and to living what is now his very best life, which amazingly in lockdown has involved running over 1,000 kilometres in under 100 days. Well, 94 to be precise. I hope you enjoy the conversation and thanks again to Foz for sharing his story so candidly with us. So Foz, hello, welcome to Team Talk. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be on.
I think, as you know, the podcast is a regular feature now where we hear from people about their stories, whether it be the highs or lows, successes, struggles, I suppose all with the aim of normalising the conversation around mental health and opening up that conversation. I think your story is one that will resonate with a lot of people. You're an accomplished sportsman, you signed a professional contract, cricket contract with Northants at 18, I think, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
And while not going maybe as far as you wanted to within the game, you had a very successful university career, both on the sporting side and on the academic side. You captained Durham UCCE. You went on from there into the city to pursue a career in insurance, and then and latterly into teaching and kind of following in your dad's footsteps. So, I mean, by all accounts, a very polished CV and perhaps even an enviable one. But throughout that period, and maybe more towards the latter stages of it, you were facing kind of significant battles in your own private life. And maybe that's a good place to start if you're comfortable with it, is kind of going back to early 2018 and the situation that you found yourself in.
Yeah, obviously you've given an overview of kind of my life, but what was extraordinary about my life is that I was essentially leading a double life throughout that time. I arrived at university with every opportunity in the world at my feet, as it were, as a 19-year-old boy who was in a very fortunate position. And I got into something that I'd never been into before. I started gambling when I was at university, like a lot of people do. What started as a bit of fun developed into a habit. Became a problem, and in the latter days, an addiction. And for 13 years, I was battling a gambling addiction throughout that time, and essentially living a double life where I was keeping this addiction totally secret, hidden from everybody, those around me, whether they knew me well or not so well. And what on the outside looked like a great life, and as you said, one that perhaps people would envy in some way, was far from the truth. My issues were not so much recognizing that I had a problem, because it was fairly obvious from the things that I was doing, and I can go into more detail in due course about the situation that I found myself in, but actually my problem was around coming to terms with it, was accepting it, and really the embarrassment and shame that I was feeling, the fact that I was so worried to reach out for help or do anything about this problem that I had, because I was so worried about what people would think of me ultimately, what the consequences might be, that I didn't do anything about it until I hit rock bottom in March 2018 when the situation had got to the point where it was essentially so bad I saw no way out, and the only way of dealing with it in my mind was to do the unthinkable and to end my life. Fortunately for me, I reached out to my younger brother at the very last moment, who kind of dispelled the myths that I had in my head about what people might think, and I was able to get the support and help that I desperately needed. I ended up in rehab. I spent 6 weeks in intensive treatment for addiction. Those 6 weeks, along with the support of my family and friends, have allowed me to get my own 2 feet back on the ground and move forward. I've learned an awful lot, obviously, about myself, but also about my addiction and indeed mental health, which is why I'm so passionate about this topic, just like you.
I think that's, yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting story. I'm thinking about, you mentioned really early at the start, you said about how the gambling started out as fun and then it moved into something more. How and when did it move from that fun to the addiction? Or how did you know that it wasn't quite what it used to be?
Yeah, it's a good point and something I get asked a lot. And actually, it was interesting for me because I think the type of person I was, the character I was kind of hooked on gambling from almost ball one, as it were, because I think for me, as somebody who was incredibly competitive, gambling was almost like a drug for me, around winning and losing. I was somebody that constantly was seeking instant response, instant reaction, gratification, and gambling gave me that on tap. And I loved it, and I became obsessed with it very, very quickly. Not just that, I think I then, as during that period, as Chris alluded to, I faced a difficult point in my life because I was released by Northamptonshire. All I ever wanted to do as a youngster was be a professional cricketer or sportsman, and I had that opportunity, and when it didn't work out, when I was told that I wasn't good enough at something, it was the first time that I'd really had to deal with that feeling in my life, and I found that very difficult. And so gambling quickly started to play another role in my life, and so that was the point where I think it started to become a problem. I also don't disguise the fact that, obviously, I've mentioned gambling's all about winning and losing, and unlike some people, I won early on. And I think winning can sometimes be the worst thing that can happen to people, because essentially it gives you that kind of hope, but also you then spend a lot of time chasing that feeling, that kind of elusive first win, which you really can never replace. And I spent a long time doing that. So I think it went from being a bit of fun, which it was, something that I did with my mates, to being a problem or playing a very different role in my life very, very quickly, or quicker than a lot of people.
Did you notice that, I don't know if it was at the same time as your cricketing career, but did you notice that the gambling went up as the cricketing career became less prominent, or was it not entangled in that way?
Yeah, I mean, certainly my first year at university, I was still contracted, and that was still very much my focus. Gambling sort of went alongside it, and it was a bit of fun. And then obviously when I was released and was dealing with what came with that, gambling was a way of kind of replicating that rush and buzz that I used to get from playing, that feeling. And so it was really at that point that I started to do it more. And it started to play a kind of bigger role in my life. I think one of the mistakes that I made, and one of the things that I try now and kind of educate, if you like, other people about, is that one of the mistakes that I made is I kind of felt that I was invincible. I thought, well, problems of this kind don't happen to people like me. it happens to people from, I don't know, broken homes, dysfunctional family backgrounds, troubled circumstances, not people who are successful like me. So even if I recognize I've got a bit of a problem, it won't ever get worse than this, because it doesn't happen to people like me. And looking back, that was a huge mistake.
Yeah, I mean, it's so easy to see how, especially with the kind of the modern connected world, how easily it is to fall into gambling. And I'm sure we'll kind of come on to that. But one of the points that I was interested in kind of hearing more about is the effect that the gambling had, and almost this kind of double life that you were leading. What impact did that have on your relationships?
Yeah, I think
with friends, family.
Absolutely. I think one of the mistakes people make is when it comes to things like gambling is they only ever judge it financially. And that was a mistake that I made. I only ever thought about money. I only ever thought about the impact that it had on my financial situation. I never thought about the impact that it had on my time, the opportunities I wasted as a result of spending what was so much time doing it. But of course, the impact that it had on my mental health, the way it made me feel about myself, made me feel about the world. I don't mind admitting that I suffered from all sorts of different mental health issues, whether it's anxiety, anger, depression, insomnia. All these things came as a result of my gambling. But I never appreciated that could be a consequence of them. The other aspect that you touched on there is the impact that it has on other people. I was incredibly selfish for 13 years whilst I was gambling. I only really thought about myself, but actually in reality I was a liar, I was a thief, I was a manipulator. I only thought about, well, what impact is it having on me, not the impact that it's having on other people. And it's certainly affected relationships from a trust point of view. I shut people off because I didn't want to get found out. And it did. It impacted on almost everybody that was part of my life, whether on a day-to-day basis or from time to time.
Yeah. I mean, it's my situation was obviously pretty different to yours, but the impact on relationships is one of the real kind of the real commonality, I think, in a lot of the ways in which we engage with and deal with our mental health, or rather lacking or failing to deal with and engage with our mental health. And one of the things that you touched on is this feeling of kind of anxiety. I know we've talked in the past around this kind of idea of feeling isolated, of feeling alone because of this dual life. You kind of touched on it, but how did you know when the time was right? Like, how did it get to that point? And what was the difference in April 2018, when actually you did go and get help? What was the thought process? How was it different that time than it may have been previously?
It's an interesting point, and I think for me, like a lot of addicts, people that suffer from addiction, is that you need to almost hit rock bottom to do something about it. I think for a long time I perceived my issues, I perceived the problems that I was dealing with in terms of mental health as a kind of sign of weakness. I thought it kind of made me pathetic. I was worried that people were going to judge me if I was going to talk about it. But actually, at the point of when I actually reached out, it was my younger brother I spoke to for various different reasons. And one of the things that he said to me in that kind of those last moments was, look, you can talk to me about anything. And that was what I needed to hear. And I think I've since discovered, and obviously I'd wish I'd discovered it earlier, that people's reaction to what was going on and me as a person was very different to how I'd perceived it in my head, how I'd played it out for that however many years I thought this was going to happen, that was going to happen. And until you actually do it, you don't know what people's reaction is going to be. It's just a fantasy in your head. And that's what prevented me from doing it for so long, and why I try as best I can to encourage people now to speak up as early as possible, because actually what people will do, what people will think and what people will say is very different to what you think when you're in that situation.
You used the word addict earlier, and I wonder whether you felt, when you were gambling, did you think I'm an addict, or was it, or did you think that, or was it when you realized that that was happening that you then got help, or was it only afterwards looking back that you say, that's what I was?
Yeah, I think it's a kind of combination of a couple of things, really. I think part of my recovery process, part of the rehab process, was that acceptance. That was huge for me, accepting that that was who I am. It doesn't define me, but it's kind of part of me. But I think it took me to go through that process to kind of accept it and take ownership of it. I think for a long time I realized that I was addicted to something. I was actually addicted to more than one thing, because gambling was my primary addiction, but I don't run away from the fact that actually when I couldn't gamble, I would drink, because I would just try and suppress the way I was feeling with an addictive substance or behavior, similarly with drugs. And so I think it was more the kind of acceptance side of it that was big. I was in denial for a long time. I didn't want to accept that I had a problem and that I needed help from other people. I think also personally, I'm the kind of person that I thought I could deal with everything myself. I always thought I could get out of that problem. I often thought gambling would get me out of it, which is now that I realize was the last thing that was ever going to get me out of it. But for a long time, I thought, well, do you know what? I can deal with these problems myself. I don't need help. And actually, sometimes in life, you do need to realize that however big, however small, you are dealing with a problem, that however hard you try to deal with it yourself, you can't. And so for me, it was a big part of it was accepting that was the case. But it took me an awful lot longer than I wanted it to do that.
Absolutely. I mean, many people struggle to accept that. You know, it takes a long time. But you've used phrases like denial and shame, and you even said, you know, something along the lines of I thought I was pathetic. I wonder what part that those sorts of things played in the maintenance of your difficulties. You know, if you're experiencing all those things, it's going to be harder to access help.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of that was came with, obviously alluded to the fact that from a young age I was quite high achieving. Everything kind of went exactly as you'd want it to. And so when that started to unravel, I found it hard to kind of admit that. I think also culturally, and I would like to think that it's changing, which is great. And I think things like Miles Stone will go a long way to help that. But Chris will come empathize with the feeling of being kind of brought up, if you like, in a male dominated, very competitive sporting environment where vulnerability was perceived as kind of weakness. Asking for help was a sign of weakness. And I think one of the things that I was constantly battling with was that I was always trying to prove that I wasn't that person when actually I was. And I think that made it much harder. I also think that your recovery from anything like this is around connecting with people who are feeling similar things. or have been in the same situation, and I'd never had that. I didn't think anybody else had problems of this kind. So I thought, well, do you know what? You're alone here, so you've got to deal with it alone. And I now know very different, and that's great. But at the time, I think kind of culture and environment, I was always trying to be one of the lads, be the ultimate kind of strong, silent type, if you like. And actually, that's never going to be a successful medicine for dealing with problems of this kind, or indeed any problem, really.
Yeah, I mean, like I can empathise and relate to an awful lot of that, definitely. And the whether it's the sporting world or whether it's our own perceptions on you know, archaic views on strength and strength of character being that kind of stiff upper lip and silence and kind of carrying on. I mean, I personally think there's a bit of a paradigm shift now in society. I think we're moving away from that, and there are you know, that's being led on a number of fronts by a number of amazing people, and certainly the strength of character and the courage that you showed in kind of, I suppose, fronting up to what you were facing and publicizing that and making that making that kind of common knowledge to people. I mean, I remember very clearly getting the message that you wrote to your kind of your friends as part of the therapy, kind of, I suppose, owning up to what you were going through. And I mean, we've talked previously around this about how important actually that was in my own journey, and how, you know, seeing you take that very courageous step while I was going through a tough time really kind of gave me something to aspire to kind of to work towards. And support networks and communication are kind of really key themes of Milestone and key messages that we want to get across. And you know, what were the importance, I suppose, of support networks within your life when you had gone through, you know, I suppose, admitting to yourself that you had a problem, you sought help. What were the importance of those networks to you?
Yeah, I mean, enormous. I think the support networks come in kind of different forms now for me. I think when I reached out for help when I was at rock bottom, a kind of defining moment for me was the following day. I spoke to lady called Mandy Saligari, who is actually the clinical director of the rehab clinic that I spent a lot of time in. It was the first person that I spoke to who understood how I was feeling and what I was going through. And that for me was massive, because for a long time I thought I was the only person who had done the things that I'd done, was in the situation that I was in, but actually speaking to her, I realized I wasn't. And so to connect with people in a similar situation was huge. Rehab obviously gave me the opportunity to do that further, and now through the work that I do and various different organizations, fellowships, etc., I've done that, and that helps enormously. I think support also comes from people who haven't been in that situation, and now don't try to pretend to understand how you're feeling or what it must be like, because they can't, but actually just being there for you, being able to listen, knowing that they kind of got your back and that you can talk. It's amazing, really, because it keeps you going and makes a massive difference. So I think you hear a lot of people talking about don't sort of suffer in silence. And I think that is such an important message, because whatever your situation, there is always somebody who is in a very similar situation, who is feeling the same way. And by connecting to them, it's huge. People talk about the opposite of addiction being connection. And in many ways, I kind of live my life by that now.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with that more. And actually, you know, as I alluded to earlier, the courage of that you showed in kind of fronting up, and the it became a great leveler between you and me, I suppose, as mates who in truth had fallen out of touch a bit over the previous couple of years because of what we were both kind of going through. But it's amazing how when one person shows that vulnerability and that strength of character to I suppose lower the drawbridge and let people in, you immediately get something back, don't you? Whether that is
absolutely
the person that you're talking to because there is no judgment there, or whether it's, you know, even if you don't get something back, it's amazing how in a week, a month, a year's time, they come back to you and say, do you know what, actually, I wanted to say something at that point. I didn't. I wish I had, but this is what I was going through, or this is what I am going through. So, yeah, it's I think it's vitally, vitally important.
You spoke about things coming to a head. I think you said early 2018 or so. So, you know, I guess it's still fairly early days in terms of it's 2 years since you were in that position. I wonder what you do or what helps you to maintain that improvement you've made and make sure that you're on the path that you want to be. What helps you do that? What strengths do you draw on, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, it is still reasonably, well, it's still very raw and pretty recent. I think there's several things. Rehab for me was very much a kind of process, and part of that process, as I talked about already, was around acceptance, but it was also around understanding. It was understanding why I was gambling, the part that it was playing in my life. And it gave me kind of strategies and mechanisms to deal with that. There was also a realization that I could live my life without it, and that I didn't need it. But as you said, you get rid of something that's played such a significant part, you need to replace it in some way. I generally replaced my feelings with things that probably had a negative impact on my life. I now try and do things that are going to have a positive impact on either my life or other people, whether that's looking after my physical health better than I used to, or indeed my mental health. Obviously, the job that I do now in terms of going around and sharing my story and helping others is very rewarding. But from a selfish point of view, it's very cathartic. It's a form of therapy for me. It helps me and it helps other people. So it's a kind of win-win situation. And I think one of the biggest things is that, again, it's knowing that it's okay not to be okay, that you're going to have bad days. But those bad days are a lot better than they were. Trying to look at the positives, trying to be grateful. It's changed my relationship again with things like sport, which was a passion and love of mine, has been all my life. But whilst I was gambling, it had a completely different kind of role. And so I think doing things like that has been huge. Everybody's recovery is totally individual, whether it's from addiction or anything else. And you just got to do what works and what's right for you. And it's, I'm not going to pretend life's perfect and every day's easy, because it's not, but it's a lot better than it was. And so you keep looking at the positives as much as you can and keep talking to people about it. And ultimately you keep moving forward.
What is your relationship with sport now? You've spoken about how things have changed. How do you perceive it or see it now that you're on the other side of things?
I think I enjoy it for the right reasons now. Obviously, I think one of the things that's strange now is in a kind of younger generation, it's almost like gambling and sport go hand in hand. The two can't be separated. You can't watch sport without having a bet on it. I now know that that's not true, because I now love it without the kind of anxiety of, is it going to mean I can buy a meal that night or whatever it might be? So I think I love it for what it is and all the reasons why I first got into it. And I think that's great. I also completely, as well as neglecting my kind of mental health through a long period of time, I negated my physical health. I put on a lot of weight. So actually now playing sport, I realize has a really positive effect on both of those things. Cricket is something that I've always had a strange relationship with because it was my first and biggest love. And then it became my job for a while, which has its challenges, as Chris will know. And then obviously when it doesn't work out, your relationship with it is a tricky one because whether people like it or not, there's an element of kind of bitterness, I guess, there. And I found that hard. But also cricket weirdly provided me for a long time with a kind of medium or platform for dispelling or dispensing with anger. And I had quite an unhealthy relationship with it because essentially anger was a very difficult emotion for me to deal with because I'd say I'm not naturally an angry person, but I was angry at everything that was going on in my world. And cricket was one of the places where I felt it was kind of okay to get angry. And people used to think that I was getting angry because it was cricket, but actually I was getting angry at myself and the world. And I never really let that on because it was just another way that I might get found out or people might see those cracks. And so now I do have a difficult relationship with it, but I still pursue playing it because I love it and it's been a big part of my life. But I have to kind of handle that very fragile relationship with quite a bit of care.
It's
you're smiling, Chris.
Yeah, well, only because there's a kind of a cliche within cricket that fast bowlers are angry people, and Foz was probably the angriest, slowest fast bowler of all time.
Absolutely.
But having seen firsthand the paddies that he can throw from first or second slip, yeah, it just tickled me slightly. but there was one thing, Foz, that I wanted to just go back to and pick up on, which is the work that you're doing now with Epic. And I suppose, you know, you've been very honest about the cathartic nature of that work. And I imagine how that keeps you grounded and in the present. But it'd be fascinating to hear a bit more about that and the organisation and the work that you and they do.
Yeah, I mean, when I came out of rehab, I had a kind of burning desire to share my story with people, not because I thought I was some sort of hero who was going to change the world, because actually I'm not proud of what I did and I never will be. But actually the big thing for me was recognizing that from a young age, I had lots of education around other addictive substances and behaviors, but nobody ever talked to me about gambling. And yet this was the thing that very nearly sort of ruined my life. And so I wanted to educate people around it so that they were aware of the kind of dangers and pitfalls. But obviously finding a platform to do that is difficult. And Epic Risk Management, who I now work for, have given me that. My boss set up the company in a number of years ago from a prison cell where he was serving nearly a year of a 2.5-year sentence for fraud because he'd stolen £500,000 from his employers to fund his gambling addiction and had the same kind of belief that I did and started to use his story. So that was where the link came. The PCA, the Professional Cricketers Association, had done a lot of work in and the Professional Cricketers Trust in supporting me through the really difficult times. And Epic actually used to deliver their kind of gambling awareness sessions for professional players, which is not something that happened when I was playing. So I had a kind of tailor-made CV, if you like, for it. But also we recognized pretty quickly that actually gambling and young people through accessibility, advertisements, all that kind of thing is now more relevant than ever. And with my background in schools and teaching, it made sense for me to use my experiences in that kind of environment. So that's what we do as an organization. We use our own lived experience to help raise awareness and educate other people. We've identified sort of higher risk sectors, professional sport, education, the armed forces, financial services, things like that. But actually, it's now an issue that affects everybody. And also we do work with the gambling industry itself to try and tackle the problem at the source, try and make them aware of what the consequences can be, and the social responsibility that they carry in terms of the harm that they don't set out to cause. I take full responsibility for what happened to me, but actually with that potential harm comes some pretty negative consequences. So they need to try and protect their customers and ensuring that what happened to me doesn't happen to other people. So that's part of the process as well. And it's growing, as the issue grows, the company is growing. But ultimately what's at our core is that we want to kind of take the problem out of gambling and stop people going through what we did, whilst recognizing that for the majority of people, it might not be a problem. And people do need to remember that. Just like they do with alcohol and other addictive substances and behaviours.
Yeah. It's really interesting what you just said, because it ties into some work that I did in the past, where what I hope this, I'm quoting myself correctly here, but we found that often in military service people, that when you compared people from America, there were higher rates of post-traumatic stress. And in British forces, there were greater rates of alcohol misuse, which suggests that as Brits, we're more likely to turn to alcohol or addictions to help us cope rather than talking. Where, and if you think about it, classically, Americans are known for being much more open to accessing mental health support, shrinks, as they would call it.
Yeah.
So I think there certainly is a need, particularly in the UK.
Yeah, no, it's great, and I think one of the things that is nice for me is that I feel like I'm giving something back after taking an awful lot away, and it is rewarding when you see the impact that it has on other people. And I realise I'm not going to change the world, but as I said, if it helps one person, then it's worth it. And that's what motivates me to do it more than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I think the work that you're doing and the work that Epic are doing is fantastic, and you know, wish you and them every luck with that, because the message is so important, and you know, we see it every day, and you know, it's only the tip of the iceberg, I think, in terms of the people that actually come out and admit to what they're going through. And the prevalence of gambling within sport is something that everybody has to be aware of and alive to. One bit that I would like to just touch on with you, I mean, as you know, one of the charities that Milestone supports is the Professional Cricketers Trust. What role did they play in your, I suppose, in your journey from April 2018?
Yeah, I mean, I will be forever indebted to those organisations. Essentially, they didn't really play a role between me finishing playing professional cricket to picking me up off the canvas when I was in rehab. But that was down to me, because I didn't realise that support still existed. And obviously, the PCA are doing a lot of work around that. What was incredible about the organisations more than anything else is the way they treated me no differently, regardless of who I was. I'd played 9 first-class games for Durham University in cricket terms, I'd had, as a professional cricketer, I'd had a pretty unsuccessful career, but they treated me in the same way that they would have treated Ben Stokes if he'd picked up the phone and said he was in a similar situation. And that was truly remarkable. They didn't just give me support emotionally, financially. They also helped my family. Knowing that I had them as a support network was incredible. And without them, I don't think my recovery would have been as successful. I don't think I'd be where I am now. And it's as simple as that. The work that they do is phenomenal. And it's so important. And I think for a lot of sportsmen and women, I talk a lot about the fact that if you're a professional sportsman or woman, you have to make the transition out of the game at some point, whether that's at the point that I did after a very short career or after a hugely successful career playing a huge number of internationals. That transition is really difficult, and people deal with it in different ways, and I dealt with it in the wrong way. And the more support we can provide to individuals in dealing with that transition, the better, and the work they do is amazing. And I'm working with them now is great, because I feel like I'm giving something back to them. I'll never be able to repay them, as it were, as much as I want to, but to be able to do this, and I think the fact that Milestone is supporting them is brilliant, because it's for different reasons to charities or to organisations that are incredibly close to my heart.
Yeah, I'm hoping we can we can encourage ex-cricketers to reflect more positively. Every person I met so far said I was a very rubbish previous cricketer. Chris always caveats his cricketing career with, albeit an unsuccessful one.
He was a lot better than I was.
Looking back at, we like to ask people a few questions, everyone roughly the same questions at the end. And one of the questions we'd like to ask is, what piece of advice or pieces of advice would you give to your younger self, or what's the greatest piece of advice you've been given that's helped you to manage or to develop or to flourish in some way?
I mean, I think there's lots of advice you could give. I think I'd tell myself an awful lot of things, but I think one of the biggest messages for me was around kind of showing your vulnerability. I always perceive vulnerability as a sign of weakness, and actually it's not. It's a sign of strength and courage, and showing that is exactly those things. I think don't be afraid of the way you're feeling, understanding it's okay not to be okay. Lots of people are in the same position, and actually reaching out is the best thing that you'll ever do. The earlier you can do it, the better. And I kind of live my life by the motto of a problem shared is a problem halved. And for me, that's how I'll continue to do it.
And fantastic advice, and very kind of on message with what Milestone is seeking to do, and the message that we're seeking to get out to people. I mean, another big part of Milestone, and I suppose the Milestone mission, is around creating this team environment, using the analogy of sport. And obviously we're using sport as the vehicle to message and to raise awareness around mental health and ultimately open up that conversation. Who would you say is in your team, in terms of your own Patrick Foster team? And I suppose, yeah, so who are those people that help you achieve and flourish and remain on the path that you want to stay on and continue to be the person that you want to be?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've got a big team of people around me and people supporting me, which is amazing, because that helps you deal with it, helps you move forward. Obviously, as you have mentioned, we've become incredibly close again, which is fantastic. And I think one of the reasons is that we've had to deal with adversity for very different reasons. Mine very much self-inflicted, yours less so. But it doesn't matter. We both felt the same way. We both found that difficult, and having that is is great. Somebody I can talk to who's had similar feelings, been in a similar situation, but it's not necessarily addiction. Two of the guys that I work with, a chap called Scott Davis, who's a ex-professional footballer, played for Reading as a youngster, is and has become a very, very close friend of mine because he's been through the same situation as me. And similarly, another colleague called Mark Potter, who played professional rugby. They're two guys that I kind of contact or I'm in contact with on a day-to-day basis, who we've got each other's backs, and that is enormous. The team goes beyond that. I've connected with some incredible people through a kind of mutual dealing of difficulties. Someone like Luke Sutton, who I know you know very well, and has spoken and done some work with Milestone, has been a kind of bit of an inspiration for me in some of the things that he's done, the way he's talked about it. And I think the more people that can talk about it, who come from that environment, the better. And I think we've all got a part in helping each other and support each other. Having that support is invaluable.
Absolutely agree. I mean, doing it, you know, when you're alone in your mind for so long, it's so important to have those people around you that can support you and help you, and you can help as well. It also, the final question we've asked everyone for a recommendation, whether it's a book, a website, a podcast, anything, something that's worth looking at, reading, listening to, etc. What might you recommend that would be helpful or interesting for people listening to this?
There's a lot of amazing stuff out there. I've obviously read a lot around the subject, and I think for me there's kind of two different aspects to it, because there's the addiction element and then there's the kind of more generic mental health side of things. In terms of anybody that's interested in finding more out about addiction, I mentioned her name, Mandy, who was obviously my kind of therapist. She's got some amazing TED Talks out there on YouTube. If you type her name into Google, you can watch some videos. I'd recommend that. It's fantastic. Patrick,
can you repeat the name?
Sorry, it's Mandy Saligari.
It cut out when you were saying it on my screen.
Yeah, sorry. Mandy Saligari is her name.
Thank you.
And some fantastic TED Talks out there. In terms of a book, Luke, who I've mentioned, Luke's book, Back from the Edge, is a great book. I was able to connect and resonate with a lot of what he has written, and it's inspired me to write my own book, which is kind of in the process at the moment. From a mental health point of view, there's a book called Man Down by a chap called Charlie Hoare, which I strongly recommend anybody to read around mental health. And for the younger people out there, there's an app called The Hub of Hope, which is again around mental health, and it gives young people a kind of support network, shows them what's out there, other people that they can talk to where they might be able to get help. So they're just a few of kind of a number of fantastic things that are out there.
That's great. Yeah. It's plenty. Yeah.
Yeah, brilliant, Foz. And thanks so much for coming on and talking to us and being so honest and so candid with everything that you've said. I think, you know, I've mentioned this word a lot, but it takes a lot of courage to come out and speak in the way that you have. And thank you for all of the support and for being such a good mate, and wishing you all the best with the book and everything else that you've got going on.
No, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me. And obviously, it goes without saying that the work that Milestone are doing, the journey that you've just started, is phenomenal. I have no doubt that you will have an enormous effect on a huge number of people. Obviously, it resonates with me, not just from the charities that you're supporting, but obviously with you being such a great mate. I wish you both all the very best, and I will support you and I'm with you every step of the way. So thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you, mate.
Thanks again for listening and hope you enjoyed the chat. If you've been affected by anything in today's episode, then there are so many resources out there that can help in a discreet and confidential way, including the National Gambling Helpline and the Calm Helpline, details in the show notes. Similarly, if there are experiences that you've had that you think you'd benefit from speaking about, Foz is very open and approachable and has confirmed he's more than happy for people to reach out to him directly via Twitter. Again, details in the show notes. The Team Talk podcast is just one of many initiatives and pieces of content by Milestone, a mental health charity, which uses the power of sports to help normalise the conversation around mental health, to remove the stigmas that still exist in today's society, and to act as a catalyst for others to engage with and tackle whatever it is that they are facing in the knowledge that they are not alone. To find out more about Milestone and all of the stuff that we've got going on, give us a follow on Instagram at milestone.uk, on Twitter at milestone_UK, or through our website, www.teammilestone.co.uk. Come and join the team.